Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we have the privilege of tapping each week on this program, I'm pleased to say, is a good friend. His name is Bill Walton. He has been, among other things, a master of the universe on Wall Street, a successful financier there. He has become, in more recent years, a leader of the conservative movement, notably as the president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm proud to be a member. He is also the host of a terrific online podcast. You can also find it at CPAC's web platform, The Bill Walton Show. And one of the things we're going to talk to him about is a program he is taping today. Bill, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Frank.
You have a very interesting topic. There's a lot of discussion sort of in the abstract, particularly during the Trump presidency, about the so-called deep state. But you're delving down to get into the nature of essentially, I guess one might say, a fourth arm of government or fourth branch of government that is the permanent bureaucracy. Talk a little bit about what makes this such an important topic to us, really irrespective of who the president is.
Well, we talk about the power of the president, and we're going to be talking on the show about the utter lack of constitutional authority that Joe Biden has to announce the decrees he announced last week in the spirit of a true totalitarian dictator. There's no constitutional authority for him to do what he's doing, but it's part of a larger
This is just so we're clear. This is about the vaccine mandates that he is imposing on government employees and increasingly others, it seems, as well, right?
Gosh, I buried the lead. I apologize. Yeah, the vaccine mandate where he's telling everybody who employers who employ more than 100 people that every single employee needs to be vaccinated by his decree, or they'll be fined. And I'm not sure what all its other penalties would be. But notably, he's left out major contributors like the National Postal Workers Union. So it's still crony government by any other name. But the thing that this raises is the power of the state, the federal government. And we think in terms of three branches of government, the president, the Congress, and the courts. But there's a fourth, vastly more powerful aspect of modern government, and goes by the name of the administrative state. And if you look at all the branches, all the cabinet positions, or the agencies of the government, EPA, labor, commerce, all the other agencies, Securities and Exchange Commission, the alphabet soup of federal regulators, federal financial regulators, they have their own ability to create law. And if you've ever interacted with any of them on a legal matter, they end up being the judge, jury, and executioner. And several years ago, the Supreme Court made a very bad ruling called the Chevron decision, which basically said that the administrative entities had the power to make these decisions delegated to them by Congress. Now, I oversimplify a very complicated matter, but if we really want to fix government, if we really want to get our freedoms back, we've got to tackle head on the issue of the administrative state. And I've got Philip Hamburger coming on, who's a notably successful constitutional lawyer, probably one of the preeminent constitutional lawyers in the United States. And he's founded something called NCLA, which is National Legal Counsel Association. I think I've got the words wrong there, but anyway, the point is it's NCLA, and he's got about 50, 60 lawyers, and they're filing suits on behalf of people to protect them from the power, the abuse of power by some of the states, and most notably recently, the CDC issued an eviction mandate, which said if you own property, you can't evict your tenants because of the COVID lockdown, ignoring the fact that property owners also have rights, and many or most of the housing units in America, rental housing units, are owned by mom and pops, and they're just as hurt by the COVID as anyone else. So it's an incredibly lopsided ruling that is in the process of getting unwound. But Philip's been behind that, and very impressive guy.
Drill down just for a minute, Bill, on something that you touched on there, which I assume you will be getting into with Phil, namely the degree to which there is not only this power that is vested in these bureaucratic entities by statute, but Congress has seemingly increasingly added to that power by delegation. They pass these bills. We now are accustomed to them being thousands of pages long, and yet there's still an awful lot of detail and amplification and elaboration and, well, legislation, really, as you say, that is also being left to these bureaucracies to do when, under our Constitution, our representatives, people who are accountable to us, are supposed to be making our laws. And then there's also the problem that, you know, this is a further distortion of the federalist model, in which more and more and more power is being centralized at the federal level at the expense of the states. Will you get into those topics, do you think?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that. The heart of the matter is that Congress, in passing its legislation in the last 30, 40, 50 years, has tended not to write detailed rules about what it really wants to do. Instead, what it does is it passes the buck to the agencies and lets the agencies take it from a general principle to specific rules. And what that does for the politicians is it gives them plausible deniability, which they pass this bill, and then if it turns out to hurt their constituents in one way or the other, they say, oh, well, we never intended that. That was just the agency that did that. And so it's another act of cowardice by our elected representatives to be accountable for the laws they pass. And you look at something like the $3.5 trillion bill, which Pelosi is trying to foist on the country. If you get into it, you'll find that most of it is really not as precise as you think it would be. Instead, it kicks it to the various agencies responsible for various pieces of the programs. And that this is the permanent state. This is the deep state. This is what people need to worry about. These people are unelected. They're unaccountable. The federal rules about that protects these people's jobs, it makes it virtually impossible for you to fire anyone. And so it's a permanent ruling class that exists in this town that we really need to level our guns at,
in a figurative sense of the word, of course. Bill, let me just
Donald
ask you.
Donald Trump, I think if he did come back, I think I've heard him talk about it. He thinks one of the biggest mistakes he made was not getting deep enough into this problem. And if he ever did come back, or if he had a proxy to come back, he would work on this job one.
Though to his credit, he did more, I think, than any president in our history to dismantle.
Yes, he did.
Regulatory burdens that these entities at the government, federal government level, have been imposing. Bill, just before we move to another topic, which I want to get to before we run out of time with you, I want to thank you for focusing on this, particularly in the context of this vaccine mandate issue, because as you know, as a member of our committee on the present danger China, one of the things that we've been particularly concerned about is the prospect that these mandates inevitably will beget, and we've seen evidence of this already in some places, notably in New York City and others, I think, across the country, vaccine passports, that is to say, identity papers that will confirm that you have been vaccinated, if indeed you have. And that have, we're told by authorities on the matter, notably Jay Valentine, a guest on this program from time to time, will very easily conduce to something akin to, if not essentially identical to the Chinese so-called social credit system, which, as you know, is an instrument in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party for unbelievable abuse and control, really totalitarian misrule of the Chinese people. Are you concerned about that?
I am concerned that is exactly where this leads. Once you get your passport, your vaccine passport, who's to say what other behavior you'll be required to own up to the government and travel officials to. And it's pernicious because the Chinese social credit system gives you positive things for obeying government mandates. And if you are caught doing something like jaywalking, it's a negative. And if you build up enough negatives, you can't travel, you can't leave your house, you become basically a prisoner in your own country.
And you lose your job.
By the way, I did garble the name of Phillips. It's the New Civil Liberties Alliance. New Civil Liberties Alliance. That's NCLA, and I highly recommend everybody take a look at it. Yeah, the vaccine passport is the nose under the camel tent. The camel's nose under the tent.
Good. Well, we will be watching closely. When will people be able to see this program with Phil Hamburger of the Bill Walton Show?
Monday night, 7 o'clock, CPAC. Monday night, 7 o'clock, streaming in CPAC now, and it's also available on the Bill Walton Show website and YouTube. And Rumble. This one YouTube may not like because we will be taking on the vaccine mandate, and they tend to be the Biden administration's enforcer on this issue.
Right. Well, heaven forfend that they're getting any misinformation out there in the American public. And I know that won't be the case with you, but you may be treated that way. Bill, thank you for the show. It's a really important contribution to the public policy debate, and I highly commend it to our listeners. Let me turn to one of our favorite themes, Bill, and that is what the Chinese Communist Party are up to on another front, which is financing the war they're waging against us, to put a fine point on it. And a man who has been instrumental in helping them do that is Larry Fink of BlackRock. There is a you talk about concentrations of power in the hands of people who are wholly unaccountable to we the people. I don't think there's a more extreme example of it than that of Larry Fink, the CEO of a massive company called BlackRock, which has, I gather, some $10 trillion under management now. And Bill, I just would ask you to riff with me on this because in addition to being one of the leading old friends of China on Wall Street, lobbying Congress to maintain China's access to our capital markets on absolutely, preferential terms, no less. You have them involved in forcing other companies to, conduct their business in ways that meet sort of the radical left's environment, social justice, and governance agenda. And then you've got, on top of all that, the deep penetration, it seems, by BlackRock alumni of the Biden administration. So you have a kind of convergence both in the Congress through the lobbying and in the government itself, the executive branch, that again really bespeaks something that I think should give all of us pause, especially when you see the radical nature of Larry Fink's agenda, both with respect to ESG, as it's called, and China. Your thoughts?
Well, it's hard to know where the Biden administration starts and BlackRock begins or vice versa. We hear about Goldman Sachs influencing government and being a revolving door. Three of Biden's top economic advisors are all from BlackRock. Brian Deese runs his National Economic Council, which effectively makes him the top economic advisor to President Biden. Wally Andiamo, who's Deputy Treasury Secretary, which is a very powerful job. And Michael Pyle is Chief Economic Advisor to Kamala Harris. So they've got in the White House, they've got the President, the Vice President, and Treasury.
It's a trifecta.
It goes much deeper than that, but those are just the leading lights. So we really need to care about BlackRock's influence and BlackRock's agenda. And Larry Fink is, I didn't know much about him a couple of years ago until you and I started talking. And the more I get into it, the more I find him sort of the master of hypocrisy. I mean, he he lectures U.S.-based or multinationals on all the environmental, climate, and social and good governance things, while at the same time making common cause with Xi in China and essentially financing Chinese government. He lectures us about the environment and how he's carbon free, yet he flies around in his Gulfstream, and BlackRock owns about, according to some of the reports I've looked at, $80 billion in coal-fired energy plants. And you know, China itself last year financed, I think, about $50 billion of coal-fired plants around the world. So it's hard to know who he looks at when he looks at in the mirror. Is it Mr. Saint or Mr. President Xi wants him to do? It's alarming, and $10 trillion of assets under direct management. They've got all sorts of money management system, which in fact increases the number they're helping administer around the world up to 20 trillion, maybe 25 trillion. They've got the only mutual fund in China that's allowed to invest citizens' dollars or yen or yuan rather. So it's something to be watched and where this is going.
Well, if it were just a question of Larry Fink lecturing his counterparts in American business, I wouldn't be as concerned about it. I think he's actually bullying them.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken testified yesterday before House lawmakers and will do the same with Senate ones today, ostensibly about Biden's humiliating strategic defeat in Afghanistan. The unmistakable leitmotif, however, is the nature and conduct of this administration more generally. More often than not, as with the Afghan debacle, the beneficiaries are our enemies. Communist China's Xi, global jihadists, Vladimir Putin, and other thugs are delighted with what the Biden team evidently considers to be its job, the managed decline of the United States. Unfortunately, what we are experiencing is increasingly our nation's unmanaged decline, a reckless, pell-mell, even Marxist takedown of American security, institutions, freedoms, and prosperity. Joe Biden, Tony Blinken, and their ilk are upending the strategy Ronald Reagan so successfully implemented. Today it seems we lose, they win, is the hallmark of this appalling presidency. Enough already. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He's one of the brightest and, I think, most insightful, relatively young commentators in American political life today. Public policy expert across the board, but I think with a particular feeling for what's happening to our country abroad as well as here at home. He is these days a senior contributor at The Federalist and a columnist at Newsweek, also a senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research and a fellow of the Claremont Institute, a man of many parts. As well, he is the author of a terrific book, American Ingrate, about Ilhan Omar, the progressives' takeover of the Democratic Party. It's great to have you back, Ben. Thank you for joining us.
Frank, I always appreciate that kind introduction and a pleasure to come on the show.
Thank you. It's our pleasure. Let me talk to you first and foremost about your takeaway from the testimony that Tony Blinken gave to the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday. As we speak, he's preparing to do the same with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee after this program is in the can. He will do that testimony, and hopefully what we say will be appropriate, even though this program will air later. Let me just ask you, my sense of it was that while the subject, of course, was the humiliating strategic defeat Joe Biden has dealt us in Afghanistan, there was a bigger leitmotif to it all, a sort of underlying current that sort of speaks to what this administration is up to more generally. I kind of think of it as a wrecking operation And I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether that's apt or how you see both what Blinken was trying to persuade Congress of yesterday and more generally what this president and his team are up to.
Well, I think substance of what transpired in Afghanistan was a disaster for the country and a disaster for the administration. So from the political optics perspective of things, the fact that Secretary Blinken wouldn't even sit in the room in front of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He conducted the interview remotely, I think is very telling in and of itself. And it
from the State Department, it isn't as though he was out of town. He was a couple of blocks away, for heaven's sake.
Right. He wasn't out in the Hamptons as he was during the collapse of Afghanistan this time. He was in town. So it's sort of inexplicable that he wasn't there. But leaving the optics of it aside, it's been the same line from the administration almost from the start, which is defending withdrawing, but not the nature of the withdrawal. And then to the extent they have to talk about the withdrawal, it's pointing the finger at the Trump administration. It's intellectually dishonest for an administration, for a president who claims that the buck stops with him. He'll say that line, and then everyone around him and the president himself will then point the finger at everyone but themselves for the way this was conducted. Incidentally, we barely even got into, as my understanding from testimony, the issue of the phone call that Joe Biden had with President Ghani about needing to change the optics on the ground, knowing that in reality, the position of the so-called Afghan government military was perilous prior to the withdrawal. And the bottom line is, from that 30,000 foot perspective that you're talking about in terms of the trajectory of the administration and what the so-called Biden doctrine, I guess you could say, is, to the extent there is any, what would you have done differently if you wanted to inflict maximum damage on U.S. credibility, prestige, strength, and conversely, empowering your enemies to the hilt, giving them a propaganda victory, showing your allies that you're not going to stand by essentially the commitments that you've made in every single respect? And let's look at the bottom line of this. We've imported, or we are importing, tens of thousands of unvetted Afghan refugees, and Americans were left behind and there was no plan for them. And I think that perfectly sums up this reversion to an America last foreign policy.
Well, I've come up with the, speaking of doctrine, a formulation for the Bush doctrine, hailing back to my time with President Reagan. He, of course, famously described his strategy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union as we win, they lose. It seems the Biden doctrine is we lose, they win. And it's terrifying when you contemplate the implications of that, especially if it turns out, as I fear is doing, Ben, to embolden the various enemies we have, quite a number of whom are seemingly champing at the bit to act aggressively against us and our interests. You mentioned this refugees problem and the lack of vetting. You've spent a lot of time thinking about, studying, warning about jihadism, including here in the United States. Do you anticipate that as a result of the malfeasant way in which these people have been introduced, not all of them, I think, are problematic, but I fear some number of them almost certainly will be, that we will see a heightened degree of danger from Sharia supremacists inside our country, determined to do harm to us, as the Taliban obviously is as well.
The vetting or lack thereof of these tens of thousands of refugees being imported to America. A couple points that I would raise. First of all, and Kyle Scheidler of the Center has done some great work on this. There have been all manner, and incidentally also then Senator Jeff Sessions, I believe maybe he was Attorney General at the time, and Ted Cruz also put out some reporting with respect to foreign-born terrorists in this country who have committed jihadist acts. We have not shown in the past that we either have the will or the capability necessary to vet for Sharia supremacist views, starting with the fact that, of course, if you are an Islamist, in advancing your cause, you are permitted to lie. So to the extent that's the case, you're already starting at a disadvantage in a system which is built on trust and honesty. Even stepping back from that, though, there's the question of our borders and the sanctity of our borders, and also the fact that as a country is the sum total of its people. Are we putting the American people first in this time where we are living in a pandemic and supposedly that is the number one issue? Why would you ever be importing tens of thousands of people from virtually anywhere around the globe during a time like that, let alone people from a country in which over 90% of the people in polls have shown that they believe in Sharia law? The constitution that we drafted there is, of course, subordinate to Islam in within the four corners of the document, within the clauses of the document. Why in God's name would we think it was in America's national interest to import tens of thousands of people from anywhere, let alone Afghanistan, in a time like this? If the argument was people who fought for the American cause and are going to be slaughtered as a consequence of it deserve substantial consideration, or at a minimum, let's say, to be ferreted out of the country to another place that's culturally similar where they'll be safe, of course we would have that conversation. But as we know, the numbers show that a very, very de minimis percentage, a very small percentage of folks who are being evacuated were the interpreters or other people who helped us, not even getting into, obviously, the issue of green on blue attacks and beyond. It's an absolute cataclysm that we're even talking about this, quite frankly. And then the last point I'd make is just look at the refugee problems that transpired in Europe. It's clear for all to see, subsequent to Syria's collapse. Everyone can see it for what it is. The notion that at this time in this place where we are as a country, now is the time to introduce tens of thousands of refugees all across the country is utterly asinine from the perspective of American national interest. It just does not pass muster.
And that is, of course, coming on top of the 100 or maybe even 200,000 migrants, illegal aliens who are coming across our southern border. I mean, everything you said about the Afghan infusion is true in spades, presumably, in that regard, with the possible exception of the numbers, the percentage of them that adhere to Sharia, but I'm afraid there's probably some in that mix as well. Let me ask you, Ben, about another aspect of this potential threat to our homeland security. You collaborated with the editors of Real Clear Investigations, part of the extraordinarily important Real Clear family of platforms, to do a side-by-side comparison between the events of January 6th that have been widely described as an insurrection aimed at overthrowing the government brought to us by white supremacists who are the most serious threat to our homeland security. You've compared and contrasted what happened on January 6th with what happened in the course of myriad riots, most of which were enabled by or at least participated in by Black Lives Matter and in some cases at least this Antifa group, among others. Give us the sense of the bottom line of this side-by-side.
Yeah, well, it's worth noting that we felt at Real Clear Investigations that this side-by-side had to be put out. And it's kind of amazing that it doesn't really exist. It didn't really exist until we helped produce this analysis, because the media has presented the story as such a one-sided story of, as you noted, an armed insurrection on the level of 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or the Civil War. The list goes on. What we simply said is, look, public opinion polls show that there are substantial pluralities, if not majorities, of Americans who believe that both the political violence following the George Floyd murder in 2020 and the political violence that transpired on January 6th both merit investigation by members of Congress. And that has not been presented in terms of the corporate media or our political class. But if the public demands it and the media is only telling one side of the story, it's our mission at Real Clear to fill those gaps in the media. And so what we sought to do was take the emotion out of it and present side-by-side, apples-to-apples analyses of the size, scope, and nature of what transpired during these events. And then to what extent we can say that there are parallels or potentially double standards in terms of the extent to which law enforcement and the authorities are investigating what transpired and also the prosecutorial rigor as well. And so you ask, what are the bottom line findings? Well, as we show in this side-by-side, the summer 2020 riots resulted in 15 times more injured police officers, 30 times as many arrests, and estimated damages in dollar terms up to 1,300 times more costly than those of the Capitol riot. And your listeners will likely say, well, that's obvious because we're talking about over 8,700 events, almost 600 of them involving violent acts in 140 plus cities on the one hand, and a single event at a single location at the other. But the way it's presented is never to compare those side by side. And then we run through the litany of the sophistication of many of the assaults during the George Floyd riots, the weaponry that was used being substantially more lethal on the average during the most violent events there versus the weapons encountered at the Capitol. And then we go, of course, to the prosecutorial and investigative aspect of this. And of course, a fundamental difference is the Capitol riot is treated by the federal government as domestic terrorism and has those authorities investigating. The George Floyd riots were not. Although William Barr did say that if Antifa was involved in perpetrating acts of political violence, that would constitute terrorism. The riots themselves were not treated as terrorism and clearly not it. And local authorities. And that gets to the last point, which is the dismissal en masse across cities, in cities across the country, of cases involving political violence up until the most egregious of acts. In contrast to the Capitol riot, where in large measure, again, a plurality, if not a majority of people are charged with essentially glorified trespassing, they are being prosecuted in many cases to the fullest extent of the law, or at least that's the intent. Juxtapose that with the George Floyd riots, where en masse analogous charges were dropped almost uniformly in cities across the country. It's remarkable. And then the last point worth making is that those who say that there is no comparison between these events because the Capitol riot was assault on democracy in terms of the symbol of the Capitol and certification of the election, and the Floyd riots, you know, were rooted in something that's perceived as more just and legitimate. We also highlight the fact that there were attacks on government buildings, of course, during the 2020 riots, including a federal courthouse in Portland for weeks on end, the occupation literally taking usurping of power as well in terms of Chaz/CHOP in Seattle. And then, of course, the burning down of a police station at minimum in Minneapolis as well. So all we sought to do was put these side by side with every single fact and figure source so people can see for themselves where we collected our information from, the most authoritative sources being government documents all the way down through reportage, and leave it to readers to assess whether the rhetoric matches the reality in terms of the events have been presented. And so we think it's of public interest, and we hope that it's perceived as a public service.
So I think there's no question it is a real public service, and I commend to our listeners realclearinvestigations.com to check this important article and analysis out for yourselves. It's very helpful, Ben. Thank you, and congratulations on it. Let me ask you quickly, and in closing, there is talk that President Biden, I assume under pressure from people like Ilhan Omar, the subject of your book, American Ingrate, is poised to reopen a consulate in East Jerusalem, or somewhere in Jerusalem, at least, for the purpose of having some kind of representation to the Palestinians in that city, reversing a policy that President Trump adopted when he moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Talk about both the merits of this action by the Biden team, if it indeed does take it, and its likely implications, Ben?
Well, there's a case to be made, first of all, that it's in violation of law which was disregarded for a couple of decades up until the Trump administration finally moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. This is an effort to undercut that law at a very minimum and likely violates it. There's some good analysis out there demonstrating that it violates that law. But leave aside the law and the merits for a second, I think what this comes down to, and you kind of hint at it, is this demonstrates that the Democratic Party is in hock to the Ilhan Omar sort of worldview that tries to draw moral equivalence, legal equivalence, and all manner of other equivalence between the Israeli government and essentially a terrorism-backing government, or if you can even call it a government, a regime. And what this indicates is the Biden administration, knowing that it's a political third rail to actually go ahead and try to move the embassy out of Jerusalem, of course. So doing the next best thing from the perspective of those who do not have America's national interests at heart. And so it's sort of a too cute by half effort. The administration officials have indicated in questioning before that this might be an avenue that they would explore. And I do think they are going to approach it in this way. And I think you have to put it in the broader context, of course, of a reversion back to the Obama doctrine of opposing America's allies and partners in the region and seeking to curry favor with Islamist, Sunni, and Shia. So you, this would be looked at in context, of course, of the move towards Iran as well, for that matter.
It may please the Iranians. It may please some of the Sharia supremacists elsewhere in the Middle East, but I think it's going to do huge harm to our most important ally in the region, Israel, and ultimately, I think, to our interests in its security, as well as the preservation of something approaching security elsewhere in that region. Ben Weingarten, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much. Great talking with you, and I hope we'll be able to do so again in the very near future. Next up, we'll speak with one of the other brilliant young investigative journalists we have the privilege of interacting with, Natalie Winters, about the stunning insights she's getting into the Chinese-tied officials inside the Biden administration. That and more, straight ahead. We're back, and I am always ecstatic to be able to report that we are joined by one of the people who I've really come to be both hugely admiring of and incredibly grateful to. Her name is Natalie Winters, and those of you who are paying attention, I trust, are aware of the great work that she does, notably at the National Pulse, where she is its resident investigative reporter. She has also become something of a rock star, thanks in part to Steve Bannon and the War Room Pandemic show, on which she frequently appears and occasionally co-hosts. And now, as a result of speaking tours that I think she's doing both with her boss, Rahim Kassam, and on her own right, to spread the word about what she is discovering in the course of her reportage, notably and of particular importance to our audience and program and country, is the extent to which we have in our government a host of people now who it seems are actively working with or otherwise aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party. Natalie Winters, it's great to have you with us. And let me just start off by saying how much I appreciate all of that good work and thank you for taking the time to talk a bit about it with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I think you always give the best and kindest introductions. So thank you. And I could say the same about you, because you've definitely done more for the movement than I have. But thank you for those kind words.
Thank you. Well, I've got about a 50-year head start on you, so but we expect you to catch up tomorrow. Listen, I wanted to start with the just brilliant and penetrating analysis that you have been doing into Anthony Fauci, his whole, well, malfeasant conduct at the National Institute of Health's National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, as they would call it, it's called. Talk a little bit about the role that he has played now for decades, but most especially the past 18 months or so in connection with the nation's grappling with infectious diseases, and of course, especially this one we call the Chinese Communist Party virus, COVID-19.
Well, we talk a lot about Manchurian candidates. I think we know there's probably one in the White House right now, but I think Fauci is a good example of what I would call a Manchurian bureaucrat, in the sense that really, when you look at his conduct in terms of leading the NIAID, how he's led the messaging in response to COVID-19, it's really hard to say that the interests that he's advocating for and on behalf of are for the American people, given his agency's extensive ties, both via personnel and financials, to Chinese Communist Party-run labs, most infamously, the Wuhan Institute of Virology. But I think that the bigger picture with Anthony Fauci, and frankly, in my opinion, why he is so desperate to keep this pandemic going, because he knows on the other side of this pandemic, when, if ever, it ends, accountability will come. And that's when investigations into his conduct and more broadly what the NIAID has been doing, you know, even decades before this pandemic started, is because he really has been the figurehead and one of the loudest voices, not just arguing in favor of gain of function, which is, of course, you know, weaponization of dangerous pathogens, but that type of research, but really leading the agency that has been sending the highest amount of U.S. taxpayer dollars overseas to, you know, Chinese Communist Party run labs. And I think people kind of misunderstand how ardently and under control of the Chinese government, really the entire scientific ecosystem and landscape is overseas. Anthony Fauci certainly doesn't understand that because he's been funding these labs since, you know, the early 2000s. And I think this dovetails quite nicely with the story that we put up just yesterday. But people may recall, you know, over last weekend, The Intercept got a lot of documents via FOIA with regards to a 2014 grant called Understanding the Risk of Bat Coronavirus Emergence. And while that's kind of a hard, confusing headline, or title rather, if you dig into the grant, you can see there's 30 studies that were published underneath that grant. All of them were funded by NIAID. 13 of them counted authors from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And what's really interesting about this grant is someone who has read all those studies, you know, the PDF, the actual publications, you can see that the grant money is described not just as going to EcoHealth Alliance, which is the New York-based group that people may have heard of that was collaborating with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but these funds are also explicitly stated that they're going to Wuhan Institute of Virology researchers. But what's really interesting and kind of the story that we have up at the National Pulse is that Southern Medical University, which was formerly known as, I forget the exact name, but it was a military university. It's still under control of the PLA. You can go on their website. You see it's described as being a, quote, arm of the PLA and their biochip lab and their kind of weapons procurement asset of the army. And this is a university that was actually supplying the studies that were completed underneath this grant with human blood samples so they could do this sort of gain of function research, what they call recombination analysis. So while this is just an anecdote and just one story, I think this speaks to the bigger problem with funding, you know, any form of scientific research with the Chinese Communist Party is that you have that civil military fusion, but more broadly, just the lack of oversight from Anthony Fauci. And I'd also add that if you look at the NIAID and NIH grant database right now, which, believe it or not, in a true Chinese Communist Party fashion, they actually took down a few weeks ago. They took the database down, but after we reported that, they put it back up. So no coincidences in politics, but no. Maybe there is one there. But they're actually still funding this university, Southern Medical University. And throughout 2020 and 21, 13 grants have been given to Chinese state-run scientific organizations from the NIH, totaling over $4 million. So these people have not learned their lesson. And I think that's the takeaway from the pandemic. Obviously, people like you and me think there's no reason that we should ever fund scientific research with, you know, in collaboration with the Chinese Communist Party. But even people who don't view the CCP the way that we do, I think this pandemic proved that it's not worth funding a regime, an entity that is not going to be transparent. You know, if there's some lab accident or an intentional release, if you can't get any transparency, it's not an investment or a risk worth taking.
Well, those are all very sensible points, Natalie Winters, but it does seem to me that they're true in spades if you're talking about the biological warfare program of a hostile power that's made little secret of the fact that it intends, in the future at least, to use such products of that research against you, perhaps with murderous effects. I believe they've done it already, in fact, with this COVID business, but certainly there's talk, as you know, about ethnically tailored biological diseases, that weapons that they have been working on for the purpose of eliminating, you know, people like us. So this brings me to one other point before I switch gears with you. Lawrence Sullen, as you know, has been doing some very interesting work on other research being conducted by People's Liberation Army scientists associated with the Chinese Communist Party's biological weapons program. Only they're not at Southern University or whatever it's called. They're not at Wuhan Institute of Virology or elsewhere in China. They're here in our own research institutions, laboratories, academic centers, and so on. What do you make of that, Natalie? And shouldn't that also be brought to an abrupt halt immediately?
Yeah, I think that that is a problem that people really fail to understand, the level of just infiltration and really the percentage of employment that you see from Chinese Communist Party, either educated, trained, and I would argue frankly, controlled researchers operating at American universities, right? These exchange programs, for example, I'm inclined to think about the Galveston National Laboratory, which is, again, funded by entirely by Anthony Fauci's NIAID. But this is a lab that actually trains the researchers at the Wuhan Institute of Virology how to work with, quote, the world's most dangerous pathogens, which are something that I want nowhere near the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. But this exchange program works both ways. And a lot of Wuhan Institute of Virology researchers are holed up there learning how to, you know, conduct sort of gain of function type research. But, you know, I also think the point is with this research, you bring up these like viruses that are tailored to specific races or ethnicities. You know, there was like some controversy over 9/11, where the editor in chief of Global Times, which is, of course, a state run outlet, he predicted that there would be another, quote, deadly, terrorist attack on America. And I think in some ways, we've already seen it. It was just bioterrorism. It happened with this virus that you so aptly called the CCP virus. But I think that one more thing, a little off topic, but that is really important and something that I've been paying a lot of attention to with regards to the Chinese Communist Party infiltration in academia and on campus. People may be aware of the China initiative that was started under President Trump in 2018 to go after basically all the ways that the Chinese government exploits American business and academia for purposes of intellectual property theft, espionage, and just more broadly, infiltration. I think that's the best way to sum it up. And in the last month or so, just as, I think that the narrative much, spearheaded by people like Lawrence Sellin, in terms of the PLA infiltration into American universities, there's been a lot of pushback from either kind of the Stop AAPI Hate Coalition, but also even from Stanford University. 177 professors from there just signed on to a letter, basically lobbying Biden's DOJ to end the China initiative, to stop using these resources to go after, Chinese Communist Party linked academics. And I think to me, that is something that's really, really, really scary. And frankly, even scarier under the Biden regime, as we call it at the National Pulse, not just because one of Biden's top DOJ officials is just on leave of absence from Stanford University. So it's all her colleagues who are lobbying her. But these people now kind of want to exploit the, CRT infused narrative of, oh, it's racist to go after CCP-linked academics, it's just on the grounds of race, which you and I know that's not the case at all. This has to do with a, brutal regime that oppresses its own people more than they do anyone else, and their efforts to exploit American taxpayer dollars, ingenuity, and research to aid and abet their own regime. So I think that is something that we need to, lay the line down here and say that, the China initiative should never be halted. It's critical, it's important, and I think it's very, very interesting that there are massive lobbying efforts to stop that now.
It seems as though it's got its parallels in other pressure that the Chinese are bringing to bear, notably to get their friends on Wall Street to weigh in with the Congress, not to put into place legislation that would interfere with their access to our capital markets, for example. But to your, and we don't have a lot of time for this, alas, Natalie, but to your point there at the end of your last comment, the Biden administration is now riddled with individuals from the commander-in-chief on down who have been implicated, I believe, compromised or otherwise subverted by the Chinese Communist Party over the years. I don't think there's anybody in the country that's done a better job than you of bringing this to light. Our team has been doing an accountability initiative aimed at trying to showcase some of this as well. And I commend everybody at accountabilityinitiative.org, as well as Natalie's wonderful reporting at nationalpulse.com. But just give us kind of an overview, if you would, of the extent of this problem, Natalie, as you see it, and the degree to which it really represents a serious threat to our institutions, to our security, and to our freedoms.
Well, thank you for your kind words, but I will say that the Biden regime makes it fairly easy to track all the varying levels of compromise that in many of their officials, all the way from top to bottom, from Joe Biden down to Frank, probably the interns,
have. And I think the probably the best story to just encapsulate the both ideological but also financial compromise that goes on in that White House, you were bringing up the stock market and how, as you know, you and I both agree that any of these CCP or PLA linked companies should not be allowed to be traded. But Joe Biden's Deputy Secretary of State, this is someone who's very powerful. Her name is Wendy Sherman. It's a name that everyone should know. She actually, amidst this whole Afghanistan debacle and amidst COVID-19 pandemic while Americans are dying from the CCP virus, she actually invested in some sort of ETF, an exchange-traded fund, that was one of the top investments was Tencent, which people may know is a, you know, Chinese Communist Party-linked technology company that's critical to the regime's kind of ambitions to really become a global hegemon. And it's that level of compromise, whether you want to attribute that to just ignorance and not understanding the CCP as a threat, or frankly, in my point, I think this is the distinction that I draw a lot on War Room between the idea of elite capture as opposed to elite merger. It's that these individuals, these apparatchiks in the Biden regime, they have so willingly and just sold out to the Chinese Communist Party that they're okay with investing and aiding their rise through their investments. And, you know, Wendy Sherman, I think, is a really, really good example of this, not just because she's also taken trips to China from an influence group known as the China United States Exchange Foundation. She's called Xi Jinping Extraordinary. And her husband, believe it or not, he used to be a journalist. He actually accepted trips from that same influence group, the China United States Exchange Foundation, that we exposed as forcing these journalists upon return to give the Chinese Communist Party, quote, favorable coverage. So that's just one person, again, who's the Deputy Secretary of State, which is a very, very important role in the Biden White House. Just to speak to the level of compromise, and I could go on and on and on about all the different people, but it really is an issue. And I think you see it right now firsthand with the whole Afghanistan debacle. And I think the distinction that we draw there is it one of incompetence, or is it one of not believing in America, not believing that Americans are worth saving? Because frankly, I think that reflects in the ideology that allows you to be compromised and sell out to the Chinese Communist Party.
That's such a telling point. And it's one that I've arrived at myself in a commentary today, Natalie, as you may have seen, that talks about, you know, whether what these people really have embraced and for which in many cases they've been well compensated for embracing, is that America is in decline. China, the communist Chinese state, is the ascending power, and we just have to manage our transition into an inferior status. And it's terrifying that such people are in senior positions in our government, and especially when it seems as though they're not exactly managing our decline terribly well, and it seems more unmanaged, at least an unmitigated disaster. Natalie Winters, we have to leave it at that. This has been such fun. I hope that you will come back to us again soon. As ever, you keep giving us good things to visit about and inspire us with. And I appreciate so much what you're doing, especially at your tender age. You are really a phenomenon. And I know you'll keep up the great work at National Pulse. And I'll talk with you soon about it in greater detail, I hope. I hope we'll be talking with the rest of you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.